Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
It's true. He is Andrew Main. He showed me a picture of himself and said, I'm Andrew Main.
And Justin Robert Young.
Hi, friends. It's your old pal Justin Robert Young here, bringing you all the hot deals for New Year's Eve.
Gentlemen.
Is that a popular time for hot deals, Justin?
Yeah. Listen, the countdown's on, everybody. Weird things are here, and we are here to bring them to you. Take it away, Andrew.
We've got a few weird things to talk about, and I thought what we would do is, one, we might recap just a little bit of kind of the really cool thing that happened this week, and then maybe, since this is our last episode of the year,
yeah,
go into our predictions for next year.
Oh, I didn't even think about it. That's great. We get to do predictions. Sorry, I saw that Justin's wearing a hoodie. I'm going to put on a hoodie, too. For the audio listeners, two out of three of us.
I'm going to keep adjusting my hoodie to see if Brian does the same thing. Anyway, go ahead.
So, to start off with, anything exciting happened this year?
Holy cow.
Anything at all this week? Anything kind of big or cool?
Yeah, to be honest, I would love – Justin, unfortunately, couldn't join us for our special live coverage of the SpaceX first stage landing, the historic SpaceX first stage landing. You were finishing up on Current Geek. What was it like to not be watching live or to be on the periphery of what clearly was an earthquake of excitement through at least our circles of the internet?
Well, you know, I felt like I tuned into the famous USA over Russia Miracle on Ice. You know, like literally as they were signing off, like as Al Michaels was saying, "Thank you from all of us here at Lake Placid, a historic event that no one will ever forget." And then, you know, an infomercial for the Slap Chop came on. You know, so. It was I got there. I was watching just as everybody was freaking out and they were deploying the satellites. You know, it was certainly something. You know, when it's even just hard to kind of wrap your head around exactly what this means, except for the fact that like this just means the future is here, and now we no longer have this like crazy future goal. We just have a lot of regular like, oh, okay, so now we just sort of have a schedule of like, let's take this apart, let's put it back together, and let's see how many times we can do this to the point where we start relaunching these. But now it's not crazy anymore. One might say that we can stop dreaming about this one dream because we've actually awoken to its reality.
Yeah, the man. If you missed it live, it was positively electric. We've talked about the importance of this as a proof of concept. The ability to land the first stage of a rocket means massive savings. It means the ability to potentially reuse all of the rocket. And I'm sure you know we'll be hearing about how the rocket you know fared and you know how many microfractures, and they're going to go over everything with an ultra nano fine tooth comb. But they're in that moment. Watching this thing fall to Earth and then seeing it just blast and just very quickly, very precisely land in the center of that launch pad, it was electric. It was like this changes everything, and you just saw it with your own eyes. And then it went on to have a flawless deployment of how many satellites was it in that array?
I think like 11 or 12.
Yeah. No, it was amazing. What were your thoughts, Andrew?
To begin with, I thought SpaceX did a wonderful job of their own coverage of it, and it's really worth checking out. Go to SpaceX.com, click on the Orbcomm launch, and it's about a 45-minute presentation, and it's light years ahead of where these presentations have been before, where you know somebody with a Midwestern accent you know describes something from some nameless place, and you get a lot of technical details that are kind of meant more for aerospace journalists. They did a really great thing. They had actual mission specialists and engineers from SpaceX. They had some very photogenic, very nicely, you know, I'm trying to, these are people who are very smart, but they're very relatable. you know, they weren't dweeby or whatever sometimes you kind of expect, and not to be, you know, use a pejorative about a lot of engineers. It was, I thought, a very well-presented thing that they did using their own people instead of somebody coming in and acting as an intermediary and telling us, you know, having the people there share with us what they're doing, a young group. It was very cool to see that. I loved hearing the SpaceX engineers talk about what they're doing and showing us, explain it to an they brought in, I forget the name of the guy who, a guy does some web stuff who, you know, has talked about SpaceX before as part of it. And he was helpful, but really they did such a good job. They didn't need to have an outside person tell us what they're up to. And that was great. And it helped. You appreciate it.
Sorry, real quick. I just wanted a second something that you said, and it was what struck us when we toured SpaceX was just how young and vibrant a company they are.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, by age, like they are a very youthful group. For whatever reason, if you had the impression like I did that it is a bunch of wizened old engineers, you know, that are putting this together, it looks closer by physical appearance and age to a really rad custom garage than it does to a bunch of white beard engineers putting things together. And I think that was fully on display during the live coverage.
Yeah, and to be fair, they do have their share of, you know, senior level experts who are people who were very imaginative and young at heart and who are very excited about, you know, finally seeing this opportunity happen. And so it's the two people on your left there both worked for SpaceX, and they had a couple other people they talked to who worked on the engine thrusters, et cetera. So it's a paradigm shift, because now it's a very different game. And you look at – one of the things that's disturbing when you look at scientific research papers, you find that the average age of somebody who gets published keeps getting older and older and older, even older than the median age of the number of scientists. And it's the old guard in many ways sort of protecting – their turf to a degree.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes very hard to be disruptive of that. There is reasons to somewhat be conservative in many ways, because you don't want people to throw out good ideas. But in other instances, you know, you want to embrace new ideas, and that's what Elon Musk did, and that's what you have a team there. You look at the Jubilant team right now, we're watching the video feed of the mission control in Hawthorne, California, and you just see all these cheering people, and I guarantee you probably maybe 1 in 10 of those people was born before the last Apollo mission.
Oh yeah, no, I man, that's a really good point. The last Apollo mission was what, 73? Wow, wait, in my lifetime, holy crap, it just hit me. In my lifetime, no living person
on the moon
has set foot on the moon. And it's wow. I'm sorry, I'm taking a moment here. dude, well, I'll tell you what, watching that crowd go absolutely nuts, it was like seeing the middle of I mean, it is so electric, people losing their crap. Listen to them. The response, it looked like the biggest concert I'd ever seen, because, of course, you have Mission Control on the inside of this glass box, and outside of it, you just have throngs, just demon hordes of the most excited, optimistic folks.
1972, pardon me, that was the last Apollo. So
still before my time, yeah.
Yeah, no, even more so. And so all of our time. And so it's interesting, because afterwards, you know, again, we've been championing SpaceX back and forth. We certainly make, you know, a bit light of, you know, the Blue Origin back and forth, but we're absolutely fans of what Jeff Bezos is doing. Anybody who's putting something on the line trying to advance space in a meaningful way, we're absolutely for. I was personally gratified to see the coverage of this afterwards and feel like, man, you know, the things that we've been trying to tell people, journalists are catching up to, and there was a really good coverage, I think, for the most part, explaining the significance of it. And there was, you know, it was, and some of it I thought, like, some of the championing, I would agree that technically this is the most significant thing since probably Apollo 11, when we actually took a rocket, you know, we landed a rocket on the moon and then took off from it, which was an incredible technical achievement. And even at the point of discounting, I think the shuttle was a great achievement in its own way, but it was not nowhere near fully reusable, whatever. The gliding down was a very cool component, but I think this was a much more significant leap. But I read one account where somebody's like, I think this is greater than Apollo. And it's like, I can understand how we can make an argument that reusability is that, But let's not discount how much, how quickly, and what we learned from Apollo. It's certainly not become a sustaining thing. It certainly didn't. You know, I was explaining to somebody last night, like, yeah, no, we haven't been back to space in over 40 years, to the moon in over 40 years, and they were shocked. Well, why? I'm like, well, because it was PR. You know, it was beat the Russians, and once we did that, you know, the point was done.
Ate an egg on it. What else are you gonna do with it?
Yeah. So speaking of Jeff Bezos, really quick.
Enough of this sober-minded talk about all the about what this means for space. Let's get, because have you been listening to this show? This is not news. We've been telling you this. You know, half of this podcast for the last 3 years has been explaining to you exactly how significant this thing that happened this week is. So regular listeners are not going to be shocked to find out, yes, indeed, everything we've said is exactly what this means. Let's get into the dirt. Let's get into the Bezos-Musk back and forth.
There's some part of me that actually thinks that might be like some version of the Cola Wars, but with rockets, would be like the best thing about the teens in the 21st century. I obviously, you know, only the planet would win if these two got in a pissing contest to see who could create better technology than the other. And I understand that in that moment, Jeff Bezos, of course, you know, you got to say something. Maybe he overstated his position when he said, "Welcome to the club, guys." Like, oh, look at you, pat on the head, Elon Musk. Ah, I'm glad you finally caught up with us here at Blue Origin.
Yeah, if you go to the Blue Origin site, and you know, Bezos has talked about, you know, their goals, orbital and other things like that, but their site's all about space tourism, which I could give a rat's butt about space tourism. I really could. I mean, I don't think that's a viable thing. I mean, yes, there will be, and there will be companies that do it. But as far as really advancing the art, I'm not that excited about the fact of, you know, to quote the prize-winning Taiwanese journalists who make the wonderful videos, sending rich douches into space, yes, you know, for a total of 8 minutes so they can go back home and brag that they've been in a space is not that interesting to me.
Well, and the problem is that you're right. It's not sustainable. Like, the interest, let's say it does become affordable enough that everyone could do it. Well, if everyone could do it, then it's about as interesting as scuba diving in Cancun, you know, which again, you're not going to create a world-changing industry that way. What you are going to do is, if you're able to make it cheap enough for us to deploy, you know, mining robots to start, you know, harvesting extremely rare, valuable minerals or create space stations and asteroids and all that stuff. Now, that is something that,
well,
that you
could
change
the
world with.
The thing is when it comes to space tourism, what Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin both talked about, yeah, we want to do satellites. None of the hardware they're testing is for that. It's all suborbital. So, you know, the New Shepard, which they set up, it's a suborbital thing. It's designed to go up to the Kármán line 100 kilometers and say, hey, you're in space. Now we're going to fall back down. And, you know, is it any better than spending an hour on the Vomit Comet, you know, doing a parabolic? I don't know. And I mean, I don't, not to discount it entirely. Personally, it just doesn't excite me because it's like, hey, you know, there are a lot of rich people to pay for this experience where, you know, for me, and I think for both of us, all of us, we're into the hard science. We're into like, yeah, but let's really push this further.
And you know what's funny?
To make the case for it, I think that, like, you know, we are all entertainers, you know, that we are all experienced designers on some level. There is a rad world where you can dress up that 8 minute in space thing to be something magical and life changing.
Sure.
And you would really, like, you know, bond with it. It would be a seminal defining moment of your life. What I think is undeniable is that what Musk wants to do, what SpaceX wants to do, is, you know, to quote Tom Hardy in Inception, to dream a bit bigger, darling. You know, it's a larger goal. I mean, like, he's talking about, like, hey, look, here's hard timelines of when we go to Mars. Like, here's our timetable for when we, like, you know, this time that we landed a reusable rocket wasn't just a science experiment. It was us doing our job, releasing satellites and then landing this here. He's just operating on a bit of a different scale. And that's where I think, without that context, you know, you can get a level of equality between, you know, when Bezos and Musk are kind of doing their incredibly entertaining slap fights on Twitter. But they're really not the same company. You know, they're doing a lot of very interesting stuff, but they're so not right now, at least. Unless
and same is said for Virgin Galactic. And I remember when Virgin Galactic, I think they put out a press release saying that, you know, like, oh, Justin Bieber's, you know, one of the first people to buy a ticket on. And I'm like, I'm nothing against the kid, nothing against him. You know, but like, if that's your company's mission, if that's what your company's, you know, proud to say, like, hey, you know, we're selling tickets on board this really cool kind of experience, like, that's great.
I'll tell you what I can't wait for is what I can't wait for is once these flights get so routine that they start having to spice it up by throwing a little bit of that Universal Studios themes in there, where it's like two thirds, like on your way in, it's like, oh, whatever you do, watch out for those cosmic rays. They can knock out guidance systems.
Oh, wait,
and then you actually go up and it's like, whoa.
I totally, dude, are you telling me that in, let's say, 20 years, yes, that there's not going to be an add-on to your Disney World ticket where you take a bus, you know, all the way out to Cape Canaveral. You do a trip that is Star Wars themed. You know, it has lights and stuff.
They do.
You get the 8 minutes in, like, oh no, the gravity's out. Like, you know, like, oh, we're floating now. Like, we gotta get back down. Like, I totally think that
C-3PO gives you a job. It's like, press these five buttons in orders to reboot the gravity distortion field. But
I think, like, as silly as that is, to me, Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, they are in the entertainment business. They are more in the Disney World sphere. What SpaceX is not in that. SpaceX is a utility. SpaceX is they are more akin to, you know, creating electricity via a hydroelectric dam, right? Like they are doing things that are going to fundamentally change how we live by way of their technology. And that's just something different. And they're both rad, by the way. I want to do both. I think that it's super cool, but they're not the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like when Apple announces, here's the Apple Watch. Oh, I'm cool. And here's the deluxe gold edition. It's like, it's great, guys. That's really, really pushing the envelope there, Johnny Ive. You know?
Yeah.
So what do you think? Is SpaceX leading a revolution in space travel right now? He says.
Oh, my God. So you look at, we've talked about this before, about how, you know, there was the trajectory the space industry was on prior to SpaceX, and it was depressing. It was not very promising. There were a few people spending some money and doing some sort of little bit of development. You know, it's where Bezos was doing. John Carmack was doing that. Richard Branson via Virgin Galactic. There was, you know, little bits of stuff. And then as SpaceX kept building and building and building and putting more capital in and choosing very good goals, and the way that company has operated is really – very, very clever in the sense that, you know, they talk a lot about, yeah, we did this and we learned that's not the way to build a rocket. Like, there was between like the Falcon 1 and the Falcon 9. This Falcon 9 rocket they sent up on Monday had 30% more thrust than the one they sent up in summer.
Ow.
Okay. So I think we're all on the same page here. And I don't mean to stir the pot, but I do find it utterly fascinating that science mogul Neil deGrasse Tyson just seems to have it out for SpaceX. The headline from The Verge says, Neil deGrasse Tyson, quote, the delusion is thinking that SpaceX is going to lead the space frontier.
This was November 24th, to be fair. This was when he was doing press for the new season of Star Talk.
Right.
You know, this is, I mean, they had tried, and this is coming on the heels of SpaceX's failure to land a rocket back on their drone platforms. I'll
defend it and then I will attack my defense. And also I noticed he is yet, as far as I know, on Twitter, where Phil Plait, Bill Nye, and NASA all congratulated SpaceX.
Zip.
Yeah, Neil not so much. But Neil's position is that space is going to be, you know, sending people up in space and doing that is going to be dangerous. And we've already seen SpaceX lost a rocket. And when you start doing manned missions, the space shuttle success rate, we lost like 1 out of 60 of those shuttle missions, we lost people. So, you know,
nearly 2% failure rate, which is just astonishing.
Yeah. And, you know, we have the Soyuz capsules are very stable and secure. They lost, there were some horrific accidents in the very beginning, but now they've become a very stable war tower, so we know what they do, but they can't do much. They land really, really hard. And the Soviets, or Soviets, the Russians are now, you know, trying to improve upon the Soviet design and add like retro thrusters and things like that, but it's been slow. The Chinese rockets, the Chinese capsules are based on the Soyuz, they're slightly larger, but those have been very stable. There's not been any new innovations in the last really 40, 50 years in rocketry, except for what we've been doing via Apollo and Space Shuttle, et cetera. And Neil deGrasse Tyson's point of view is that when we start trying to push that envelope further and we want to send people to Mars or try to do that, he's of the opinion that that a company, a corporation, can't take that kind of risk. That a corporation, that the shareholders or the people who are funding this are going to say, no, 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 this is way too risky. We're not going to do that. And that's why you have to have government, which can take these risks on, is that's going to be the way
which,
it's going to happen.
Which, by the way, is kind of cold comfort to this libertarian, the idea that only the government can kill people and not have to worry about its PR rating afterwards.
Yeah. I would say that, and he's kind of looking at it sort of this sort of a you know, and we do want to be skeptical whenever people say, well, there's a new economy. Things are different now. Things are different because we said that before, and then things still go back to where they were. I will say that I would use as a counterexample to him that one of the most significant human health efforts in the last decade, the last 15 years or so, has been the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And this is where the richest man in the world put a considerable part of his fortune towards eradicating disease in Africa and lesser developed countries and has saved millions of lives
and
with
counting.
No profit motive.
I mean, there's. I mean, he could have a Norman Borlaug level contribution to society before too much longer, right? It could be a billion people that are alive thanks to his efforts.
Yeah, Borlaug, for those you know, he's the guy that helped develop forms of agriculture that just radically improved our ability to feed the planet.
Yeah, it's credit. You know, he led the Green Revolution of the 1970s in a time when you know, books like The Population Bomb predicted massive widespread famine
and was advocating, you know, forced sterilization and just horrific human rights violations to protect against a problem that we could actually easily solve.
Instead, Norman Borlaug went down to Mexico, taught people how to farm and get, you know, increase their bushels per acre, you know, by a ton. And it's thought, you know, the number that goes around, who knows how right it is that there's a billion more people alive on this planet thanks to just the efforts of him.
And a billion well-fed people, too. You should, you know, point that out.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Not just barely surviving, but thriving.
Yeah. So Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you know, for the longest time, Gates got criticized because he wasn't very philanthropic. But if you read biographies of him, they talked about he'd go on these reading vacations and he was reading books on disease. He's reading books on third world illnesses and all of this because he was planning. He did not just want to jump in and you would get a lot of – sometimes you get criticism from the nonprofit world because they're upset that you're not giving money to their nonprofit, but he was looking at the structure of nonprofits themselves and realizing these aren't that effective. There are a lot of people, you know, when you look at, you know, nonprofit CEO salaries and a lot of the people how well they're paid, you would be surprised at how much compensation there can be in that world. Not to say that it isn't necessarily warranted, but if you measure their efficacy, you find out you know, it's questionable. So he created a foundation that tried to improve itself and get better. And they made mistakes early on. They changed the way they did that. And there was a learning curve. And now they're an extremely effective foundation. And he's still trying to make it better. Zuckerberg went through the same thing. He donated $100 million to the New Jersey public schools thinking it was going to make a difference and ended up finding out that, you know, $1,000 a day consultants were making out quite well with it. And he was only kind of maybe in many ways doubling down on a problem that he was trying to fix. And there's a curve to this thing. So my point is that you can't look at Elon Musk is the first one to say there's not a profit motive in Mars. There's a value motive, and the value motive is that Elon Musk and the other people who are some of the people behind SpaceX, and I've met one of those other people who put money into it, they're not asking him, when do we go IPO? When do we go IPO? These are very wealthy people. They're like, hey, when do we go to Mars? These are already wealthy people, so many of them billionaires who aren't trying to flip this company like it's Uber. They want to see this go on to the next step. They're looking at the same way Bill Gates does his foundation, the same way, you know, Carnegie did. You know, Andrew Carnegie looked at his stuff later on in his life, same as Rockwell. All these people, once they had their money, like, okay, how do I make the biggest change? How the Howard Hughes Foundation started off as a tax dodge, and now it's become this incredible medical initiative. You know, that's where you have to think about these things.
So as it relates,
this is a legacy play. I mean, like, this is them saying, hey, look. All the money we're putting into here is so I can have on my gravestone and on my Wikipedia that will be projected onto my gravestone that I got humans off Earth.
Sure. But as it relates to you were explaining that you were going to defend Neil deGrasse Tyson's position. You know, I think his position is that he oftentimes cites the story of, you know, Christopher Columbus was the one who took government money and did an expedition with government funds to unlock the new world, and only then did the East India Trade Company flourish or whatever. To take that sentiment on, what's different about SpaceX that you think that example doesn't apply?
I mean, just that they have a business model of putting satellites in safe space, and they have ways in which they can supply this, and that they use that money and that research to keep going forward. And we saw a perfect example of that this week, you know, where we watched, as Justin pointed out, we watched a real mission, a paid mission by Orbcomm. You know, and Orbcomm, by the way, deserves credit for saying, yeah, guys, we'll let you push this back a day or whatever. We want to work with you. They've been very much championing that this other ancillary thing that SpaceX is trying to do, because they see the bigger picture of it, and then they see how it's going to make their life easier as a company providing logistics and stuff. We saw a great example of how we had a mission that was a paid mission to launch satellites into space that was also the most important milestone in aerospace in 40 or 50 years. And that's an example of how SpaceX does things. They say, you know, you talk about, like, Google talks about their 20% time or whatever, which is kind of a myth, but it's a neat idea. And they do have things that come out of that, where SpaceX is kind of like, yeah, we've got this, these are the things we're doing for money, and then we're over here trying to push the envelope, which, by the way, reusability is how we want to get to Mars, and reusability will also help us make cheaper rockets, which helps us build, you know, make it easier to have more customers and all that. I just want to say a side note in the chat room. Somebody pointed out what about Steve Jobs' philanthropy? Remember, Steve Jobs was still running Apple up until the point that he died. Bill Gates waited several years until after he left Microsoft to focus his efforts on do that. Jobs actually gave away tens of millions of dollars, but he never sent out press releases or did anything to attract attention to it. So let's not disparage the guy.
And also, you know, Jobs was legitimately robbed of a third act. You know, it's like it might have been that just now, had his health gone a different way, he would begin a large stakeholder in the world's largest company.
And like, Gates would want to do it in a smart way. These guys change industries, and they look at it and they go, wait, there are inefficiencies here. How could we do this better? He lived by standards, a very modest lived in a modest home, modest thing. The yacht was a bit of an extravagant, but he really was not a guy that was trying to, you know, was not flying around in gold-plated Zeppelins, throwing money out the window, whatever. And now that his wife is in charge of the foundations, she's the one that's going to be in charge of that. And by all counts, she is a very classy, very civic-minded woman. So,
By the way, if you've never driven around Palo Alto, where a lot of these executives live, including Zuckerberg and the Jobs family, like, it's just like a kind of regular ass neighborhood. Like, it ain't McMansions. It ain't, you know, these big, gigantic places. They're just kind of like, you know, 3-4 bedroom, regular ass, one story houses that, you know, that all of these people tend to live in.
It's a very different value set. There, many of them, it's very family focused. These people really think about, oh yeah, I don't want my kids, you know, becoming jerks. I want my kids living in a nice neighborhood. I want my kids to, you know, have a community, have that. It is I would say that a very noble sort of way of approach. It's not a false modesty sort of thing. Like, oh, I'm just a simple man. It's like, no, what will make me happy? For them, you know, right now, what's making, you know, Zuckerberg's trying to bring internet to the rest of the world. Yes, it helps Facebook, but he also is a guy that reads books like Rational Optimist and these things and understands, like, man, if we can help the rest of the population have the same access to education and communication that we do, the world's a much better place.
Yeah, yeah, that was a life-changing moment for me, reading first about the work of Julian Simon, who you know, was the first economist I'd ever read that talked about human ingenuity as the most valuable of all resources, and the idea that there are so much there's so much genius locked up in minds that they're trapped in a box. They don't get to connect with the rest of the world because they don't happen to have internet or the resources to interconnect. And if, you know, I don't care if, you know, I forget where I read the quote, but someone's like, I don't care if Facebook requires everyone to stand on their head and pledge allegiance to Mark Zuckerberg. It's worth it if, you know, the bottom billion suddenly has internet access, because all of a sudden, you know, that means – you know, take if a genius has a one in a billion intellect, then guess what? That means we get a seventh or eighth genius to join the discussion on the internet, and that's huge. That's huge for mankind.
Yeah, it's you know, touching back when you mentioned Borlaug versus, you know, Paul Ehrlich, and that is that there's that the Malthusian attitude is every, you know, that looks askance at every new mouth that's, you know, every the mouth of every new child that's born, every new child that's born, like, oh no, great, that's another burden. Where I would say the opposite point of view, and dare I say the libertarian point of view, is no, this is great, is that the world is made better by more ideas, more people, more contribution to it, and taking those people who are without the resources that we have and giving them the ability to have that is a wonderful thing that will benefit. You look at SpaceX, okay? SpaceX is founded by an African-American.
Oh, he is
African immigrant. You know, you know, funny. He's a guy that came from another country that came to here for opportunity. You know, you look at you know, the heads of Google, the heads of Microsoft, the CEOs, the people running those corporations, are people who came from other countries that because of Borlaug and the success of developing ways to improve the standard of living, we all benefit from, you know, this.
I had a friend in college who sophomore year he applied for a scholarship that was specified to only go to African Americans, and they refused it on the grounds that he was an African American, and he explained, "I'm from Egypt. Here's a map, and here's my citizenry. Can you explain to me why this isn't working?" Which I think I don't know nowadays. I think. The nuance about racial discussion has hit kind of a next level, but it's like, it's fascinating that 20 years ago, this guy was asking the kind of questions that, you know, in an age where we have people saying that they identify as different ethnicities.
I used to really argue from when I was working in journalism that I thought that African American was a terrible descriptor for us to choose to describe Black Americans. As like, I thought that was
well, and unfortunately, like, if you're really going to break it down scientifically, you would have to have like a gradient of, you know, 0% equaling minimum melanin in the skin, 100% equaling maximum melanin in the skin, and then all of a sudden you really are awarding scholarships based on hair color. And I know that there's more to it culturally, but it's I don't know, it's fascinating to me that we really are entering this kind of post-racial world.
Well, yeah, and remember that often, you know, those terms are adopted often with the best intentions in time. That they
yeah, oh, sure, sure, and not without a tangible benefit. You know, it's like you know, the regardless of how imprecise the mechanism, you know, initiatives like affirmative action and so on definitely have mixed up and introduced a lot of people to ethnicities that they wouldn't normally spend time with, and gotten us closer to a place where we can focus more on what's on the inside.
I mean, I sometimes get frustrated by identity politics, but also being a white male, you know, that's the large. It's like, well, yeah, you know, what it's like. Well, yeah, you're part of an automatic majority, so it's easy. You know, my point of view is very different than groups. There, you know, part of it is like certain groups, like, you know, the people of color groups, things like that. To say, all right, the more people we can put under this umbrella, the better. You know, because then we have a better position to sort of argue for why we need, you know, what we perceive to be equality and all that. So it's a complicated thing that's way above my head.
Yeah.
Yeah, should probably move on from this topic.
No, that's great. Look, I think we solved all the world's problems.
Yes. Let's just create opportunity for everybody to live up to their potential.
Go to space.
Dude, there's
Star Wars Star Tours that really goes to stars.
Did we talk a lot about Star Wars last week?
We did a whole After Things about it.
That's right. We stuck it all in After Things. Okay.
We'll throw you all a little plug here.
Yeah.
Support the Weird Things, go to patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yeah.
Use your support. We need your help.
Yeah, dude. It'll also get you on the weird list, Weird Things, patreon.com/weirdthings. We want to thank our – wait for it – our 434 patrons who keep us on their schedule, keep us making new content for you guys. Man, it would be rad if you enjoy the stuff that we do, if you can join our club, get some inside access, and help support this show.
Yeah, and help us stay away from racial politics.
Yeah.
Please do that. Can everybody please just, let's just never drift. That's a dangerous, we should have a some sort of nav system that just starts, beeping uncontrollably whenever we just veer into racial politics.
It's like, that's what I'm saying. It's like, Justin and I used to talk a lot about how you want to do a podcast where it's better than just two average guys sitting on a couch talking, you know?
Yeah.
And that, when I get into that, I'm like, listen, you know what? Throw a paper airplane in the air, let it hit the back of somebody else, and you're going to get just as light of an opinion from them as you will from me. So
sure. but again, that's one of the charms of our free-flowing musings about the future. So let's talk about goblins.
Goblins. I don't have I've got
uh-oh.
I've got a story. It's not a goblin-related story.
All right.
Or maybe it is. Maybe I'm just trying to throw you off the scent, if you will.
Do goblins have a particular scent?
Bus driver in India.
Uh-oh.
And he's chilling out, right? And all of a sudden, he's actually taking a nap in the back of the bus because, you know, it's break time.
Sure.
And next thing you know, the bus starts up and it starts to drive. Right.
Okay.
And he looks, and he can't immediately see anybody driving this thing. Bus careens out of control, hits two other vehicles.
I already have a theory, just from what little I've heard. This is in India?
This is in India.
Okay. And so it doesn't sound – I'm going to guess that you didn't hear a lot of acceleration. It wasn't like someone was stealing the bus and it just – you know, someone turns it on and floors it.
It was engine was turned on. Next thing you know, this thing's being driven. It's already moved.
Could it be a little minky?
You are correct, sir.
Yes!
Monkey drives bus, rams into two other vehicles. First paragraph, The Simian Menace. Already a better title than Phantom
the
Menace.
The Simian Menace!
The Simian Menace in the city took a turn for the absurd on Monday. This is a city plagued by monkeys, by the way, which... I really want to go there. And people talk about, oh, no, they'll steal your cameras. I'm like, great. I'm bringing throwdown wallets. I'm bringing stuff that they can take. That is my mission, is to get mugged by monkeys there.
Dude.
When a monkey got inside a park bus, switched on the engine and took off in second gear.
So it wasn't even a case where the bus was on and idling and he just had the AC running or something. He turned on the thing. Like, do you think he turned the key to start it? Or
it said... The monkey turned the key.
Wow. Maybe he'd heard stories about monkeys who are hooked up to things, and when they press the right button, they get cocaine. Let me just touch everything.
Is this like the physical personification of It Was the Best of Times, It Was the Blurst of Times? Like, the monkey got into the bus, turned the key, put his hands on the steering wheel, and immediately crashed it into
You got to realize they do have thousands of monkeys, and they do have thousands of them trying to steal and start cars.
I just turned this key, man. This is the one that did it, and he came so close to doing it and then crashed it into two buses.
Do you think does a monkey have enough intelligence to have seen his fellow monkeys driving the steering wheel and stuff? Like do you think he was pardon the pun, but aping what humans do?
Stop it.
Yes. I do think that they're intensely curious. Our capacity for the reason we like to watch things like how things are made is because it's the monkey instincts in us that like to that are very very tribal. We're always picking up things. You know, one monkey will learn how to put a stick into an ant mound and get ants, and the other monkeys go, "Oh, that's a great idea." And that's so much – we're built – we're hardwired to do that thing and learn that way. So, yes, I absolutely believe that's the case.
Right on.
I mean, what do you do? What do you do to stop these monkeys from stealing your buses? Like, is it, you know?
I mean, to be honest, like, and again, this is a terrible thing to think, but it's like, look, these monkeys stealing cars, stealing wallets. You know why they're doing that? Because they're bored. You want to, you know what? They want to be productive. They want to make something happen. We need to find work for these monkeys that'll be satisfying and make them feel good. I don't know if there's a – like I think about this all the time. Now, this is more of a weird things topic now. But I think about like cigarette butts all over the place. Less so now that, you know, as smoking becomes increasingly less popular. But I was thinking like –
we never should have put filters on them, Brian.
I know. That's true. I was like, what if you genetically engineered ants or birds to have a compulsion – to collect these, like they still lived and self-populated and so on, but the one thing they loved to do was find cigarette butts and put them in trash receptacles. Would that be bad for humans to create them?
I think, Brian, how can I put this delicately? I think that's maybe not the best solution for that problem.
I'm just, well, first of all, it's massively parallel. I mean, and again, this is all just theoretical. Just theoretical. I'm not actually proposing genetically engineering slave races or something. But if they wanted, I don't know. It seems like
let's say, because I think where you're going is interesting, but maybe a little too precious. And it just seems like, all right, so let's say here's what you did, right? You mandated that all cigarette manufacturers had to put something in the filters or whatever, what is most likely to be left on the ground that was very attractive to ants or something. Right. And then you put some other, like all public trash cans had to have some under part that also had some pheromones where the ants would want to congregate. And so therefore you could create something that would like have the ants bring the thing into the thing. And that kind of feels like every – like whenever they go and like introduce a species to eat another invasive species and sure. Then that species becomes dominant, it just seems like there's a million ways why that becomes just like its own problem while we're trying to solve what we could just solve with a broom.
I think that if you wanted to – you know, there are states that don't have a problem with cans being littered on the ground. It's where you have to pay a deposit on a can. And if you had to pay a deposit on a cigarette butt, every one of the cigarette butts was worth 5 cents or something like that, your homeless problem will probably cure the other problem.
Wow. Okay. Well, that unfortunately casts a weird shadow over the discussion. I guess what I'm thinking of is if I can imagine, you know, in Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy, one of the contributions to society, because there aren't really jobs, is just, you know, what do you do to help out? One of the jobs essentially is to be an eco-poet, which means in your area you try to create a sustainable environment of a few hectares. Like, oh, well, I grow this thing that this creature likes to eat, and then these predators like to eat that predator. And if you do really well, and you know, and if you have a bad season, maybe a dust storm wipes it out, you have to start all over again. Like, we can look at that and say that's good. Does it make it bad to essentially play the same game here on planet Earth? Like we don't hear environmental engineers called eco poets very often, even though what they do is as nuanced and as beautiful and as important as that fictitious contribution to society would be.
Well, I don't think anybody wants to be associated with the soft arts and humanities if they can be associated with the hard science.
Fair enough. That's not that you're biased.
I think that it's a, yeah. I mean, I kind of think that there's a reason people want, you apply engineer and sciences and people there's a bias to try to attach those things to it, so it appears to be less subjective.
So I guess here's the ethical question that I want to put out to you guys. And again, let's say the cigarette butt situation is what we're talking about. And yes, there's a million ways things could go wrong, and you know, we don't know what we're doing or whatever. But let's say it's a mature science. It's 100 years from now. We right now live in an age where I think most of us believe that golden rice is a good idea. Golden rice is was it vitamin A or vitamin – I forget which vitamin it is that it's rich in, that it self-produces – That saves people's eyesight, basically, yeah. In third world countries. We agree that it's like all things being equal, let's replace regular rice with golden rice. So let's make that the preferred way. Same thing with like fluoridated water or something, assuming it works. I don't really know. But is there a reason not to have ants just love to collect cigarette butts and trash and put them in a place?
I can't say that, no, Brian, we should not do it. I would say that it's maybe not the most efficient, you know, bioengineering an entire species to solve a problem, as Justin pointed out, might be better solved for the more simple, you know, reasons, might be better that, you know, there's that the perceived risk versus the perceived gain. Could we create a form of, you know, robot ant that does the same thing that we have a lot more capability at? I might feel more comfortable over that, but... You know that I can't imagine. So you have these ants that are designed to seek out cigarette butts. You know, great. All of a sudden, I find my 7-Eleven is infested with these things because they found out there's a lot of cigarette butts behind the counter. And again, you would imagine, you know, hey, there's ways around that. All that. I just see this is one of these things. Like maybe that's overkill.
You want to know what? Now I'm in love with the idea, Brian. I'm as in love with the idea as you are, and I just see the cover of Time magazine, Time Man of the Year, Brian on top of a gigantic anthill with billions of ants carrying trash, as a man who cleaned America.
I am, you know, I am charmed by the idea of having, you know, these little things do our bidding and all that. I'd like. You know, my fear is the, you know, the problem is, so there's an announcement came out. There's a guy that, you know, this guy who's, you know, who's been able to, who's hacked the iPhone and done some other, you know, pretty prominent, clever hacks and stuff, says that he's made his own robotic car, right? You know, he's made his own self-driving car. He says that I've solved 99% of the problem of autonomous driving, which sounds cool.
It turns out 99% of the problem is our aversion to crashing. Once you get over it, it's easy.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, and it's people like, oh wow, this guy beat Google and all that. Like, well, wait a second. That 1% is really 99% of the problem. You know, that 1% of, you know, like, yeah, 100 trips, it kills somebody. 99% of the time, it doesn't kill somebody. It's more common. But that 1% is the much bigger part of the problem that everybody's wrestling with. And it sort of, you know, it trivializes how, you know, you have your ants, these things they're cleaning up. Do they understand property lines? Do they know when to do this, when not? There's so many of these things that are solvable, granted, eventually. But are hugely complicated problems.
By the way, Tondagasa in the chat nailed it, because in this world where we have ants who love cigarettes butts, anti-smoking ads begin with the tagline, that's how you get ants, is by smoking and dropping butts.
And let me also just preemptively let me say that I was being somewhat sarcastic about my disregard for people who are studying humanities or the arts. I mean, there's like extreme value there. Because I'm just thinking like, man, some people are going to take me kind of serious on that. And I'm going to get some angry, you know, as a writer, not a scientist. Remember, this is a guy that spends his time.
Yeah. I would like to double down on my assertion that Brian should be named Man of the Year. a gigantic front page where he is on top of an ant pile.
And they'll call him some sort of ant person or ant
human.
Ant male.
Ant guy. man, do you guys want to segue into picks here, or do we got time to squeeze one more in?
Up to you guys. I can pull up another topic here. And we got to do our predictions.
Oh, shoot. Predictions. Oh, crud. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I'm going to go with the easy stuff. I'm going to start off with what we're going to see because of the successful landing of the first stage of the Falcon. Elon Musk has pretty much said that he's been waiting on certain things to happen before he announces his plan for Mars. I expect that we're going to get some sort of revelation of his BFR rocket. That's that big friendly rocket, which is the Mars Colonial Transport, which will be the largest rocket ever. I think he's going to reveal the plans for that and say, hey, now that we've actually practically tested landing a first stage, The Falcon 9, from understanding the upper stage, is not intended to ever be able to land by itself, because it's just the amount of energy it takes to land, and the thrusters, the rocket that it uses for outside of the atmosphere has got a different skirt configuration than you use. But anyhow, I think we're going to get, hey, here's the rocket to go to Mars. Let's start talking about Mars. This thing could be 20 years away, but let's have a plan to get there and go there, and this is the first big step. Falcon Heavy, which is a Falcon 9 rocket with two other Falcons strapped to it. They talked about trying to do a launch last year. We'll probably get a launch of that this year, which will be pretty cool. That'll be the most powerful rocket since the space shuttle.
Oh, man.
Or actually more powerful than the space shuttle. Most powerful rocket since the Saturn V.
Wow.
So that baby could go up in the next year, which is exciting.
And by the way, just getting back to Saturn V capacity would be huge, given the fact that we live in a world of, you know, amazing nanomaterials and carbon fiber. And, you know, you could pack so much more important payload into the exact same mass space that we had before.
Well, and we've seen with SpaceX has been able to increase the efficiency they get using even – you know, by cooling down the liquid oxygen even further, they're able to get more thrust, et cetera. So, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of improvements can be made, and that's going to be the next generation. I think we might see a next generation of rocket that SpaceX says, hey, we designed the Falcon 9 based on the Falcon 1. Now here's our next generation rocket based on what we learned from the Falcon 9, and let's improve this. I think that outside of SpaceX, you know, we're going to see big things in aerospace, big announcements. We've already seen that with the United Launch Alliance talking about how their somewhat reusable rocket system, the Vulcan, where they can capture that rocket core again and make that reusable. The game has been changed, so we're going to see a lot of other people. A lot of other talk about, hey, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. Whether that happens, we'll see. Outside of space, I think that with virtual reality, this year was supposed to kind of be the year that was going to take off. You know, and HTC Vive was going to launch its product, and that got pushed back, and we're still waiting for the Oculus to come. But I think that 2016 is going to be big for gaming in VR.
On that subject, I don't think, Justin, have we talked about our Discovery project on Weird Things?
Did we mention it when we did the special Monday episode?
No. Yeah, I don't think we did. But for those of you guys who don't know, Justin and I spent a week here in Central Texas creating 10 episodes for Discovery VR on the Discovery VR app. We'll remind you when it's time together. Don't install it now. Install it later so they see a giant spike when our content gets released. but it was fascinating. Shooting for VR is a fundamentally different experience. It's so amazing to intentionally set up your shot to where knowing that the viewer will start off looking at you and you'll talk to the viewer and engage them, that you can set up kind of magic tricks to reveal where you are and point to the other side and have them turn around and realize, oh crap, I'm at the Alamo. I didn't even know that. And it was amazing.
Spoilers.
Yeah, sorry, spoiler. Maybe not the Alamo. Maybe you're underground. Who knows?
We were at Alamo Rent-A-Car.
The Alamo Draft House Rent-A-Car. Have a beer. Get behind the wheel.
Yeah. Man, is it in its infancy? Like that's the craziest thing about VR to me is like we're in this dual race to not only create the products that record, capture, and view this material, but also like everybody is feeling, you know, we're all a bunch of blind men feeling this strange thing and wondering exactly what kind of creature it is. Like it is
great. And there's surprising things that the rules have changed, right? Like it used to be that when somebody had camera equipment and they were shooting a news piece, you knew you could stand in a certain area and gawk because, you know, it's interesting to watch people shooting a thing. There's people, you know, speaking, you know, to a camera, but you can't do that. The two biggest challenges were the producer, the director, the sound guy or whatever all had to hide behind rocks and trees and stuff every time we went live. And all of a sudden it was a new form of directing where it was more up to the talent, to Justin and I, to let him know how it went because he can't watch it live. There's no ability. You know, it's like he has to hide behind a rock so he's not showing up on camera. Likewise, when people are sitting around and they're like, oh, those guys are shooting something, people had to go over and be like, hey, man, it's fine to be here. Just please don't look at the camera because you're going to be looking at a person having their experience the whole time because you're on camera right now. And they're like, oh, and I don't know. It's fascinating. I mean, talk about just nobody knows the new rules and the new challenges in this medium.
Yeah, I was brought in last year on a couple couple things, and my observations were that the technology for capture is really not there yet, in that you extremely limiting, particularly like with 3D VR, because 3D really works within like arm's distance, and the systems I was asked to evaluate, you can't get within arm's distance of anything. And I said, well, it's great that you can say that you can do this. And the capture methods were, you know, was either, you know, 20 GoPros in a circle or whatever, or big ellipsis, whatever kind of thing. And then you didn't have any live feed, you know, it still wasn't there. Everything had to be post-processed. And I had friends that were working on like the Justin Lin, segments and stuff like that. And you had people coming in from traditional Hollywood or like, let's do this. And like, no, you can't do that. And then you had other people like just last minute inventing silly gimmicks. Like, oh, now we'll have everybody look over here. And it's like, yeah, but when you have the goggles on and you're in there, the last thing you want to be told is now turn all the way around to go look at this, because you're like, ah, that's annoying. You know, that's really – that's the problem. And it's, again, we have to go through this phase. We have to go through this phase of figuring out what works and what doesn't work. And so that's often – and that's when often people will give up. They'll say, nah, it's not going to work. And then people stay with it. They figure out best practices. And the next thing you know, you have an exciting medium that's everywhere. And people are like, oh, yeah, we love this.
But I will say this, if there is one thing for the ever, what is this, our 20th consecutive year of this is going to be the year that VR is the thing, like the reason why I think that there is more reason to be optimistic about it this year is that there are tools that people can screw around with, and there are cheap ways that people can view them, either between Google Cardboard or like the Discovery VR app is just 3D, or, you know, like, you know, move your phone around, a video. There is more ways that people can, if you're screwing around and you're having a good time. And thankfully the crew that we were working with on these videos that we shot were so open to us just being able to kind of put our personalities, front and center and use the 3D elements to be more like, hey, this is a cool way that you can immerse yourself with a couple guys having fun, as opposed to just saying, hey, look, like, is there a sound behind the tree? Turn around and you'll see it. Like, you know, I think we made compelling content, and that to me is exciting, because you can just, you can, it's exciting. Like having camcorders were in the 80s and 90s, where it's just like, hey, look, with two VCRs and a camcorder, I can edit together my own movie. And now with the internet, I can upload it and people can share it. Like, that's what it kind of feels like now.
It sounds like, cause like, yeah, I mean, like I would, and every time I talked with these VR companies, I'm like, let me guess, how much of your demo is a skate park? You know, I'd be like, well, cause it's like, you know, like, yeah, cause you realize that, well, if we put this in the middle of a skate bowl, then we can capture all this stuff. I'm like, yeah, it's, everybody does it. I'm like, oh, we're going to throw it on stage at a concert. We're going to capture the live at the concert. It's like, you got to think bigger and broader. I think that's what's exciting. What these people did with you guys is brought you in and said, hey, let's put you there with these two guys showing you this. Let's put it there. Like, what if Justin and Brian brought you to these locations? And that's a very important step towards making, you know, really utilizing
that, it. And to be honest, that's one of the most exciting aspects, is that, you know, in the early days, the content is just about the method of delivery. In the earliest days of high definition, you would tune in to Discovery HD just because you knew they would be showing something in HD. And that's why you had stuff like, you know, was it Sunrise World? Or something like that, where it's like it was literally just an hour of watching the sunrise just so you could marvel at how high definition it was. And then it took a while to inject the human elements, and as HD stopped being novel in and of itself, all of a sudden it became about the personalities and stuff. And I like the fact that they're jumping ahead and asking us to inject personalities in there. One more thing about VR and goggles and so on. I can't believe I'm thinking this, but just 1 year has really, 2015 saw me totally kind of give up on the Oculus, because like all of a sudden I realized the Oculus, you still have to be attached to a computer that renders everything out. Like the idea of being physically tethered in a world where Google Cardboard and so many devices, you know, your phones are powerful enough to give you this experience just seems silly now.
Yes, but the experience between a Cardboard and let's say an HTC Vive, mm-hmm. it's a magnitude order of difference. It's in it. These, the, you know, not to pull my own cred here, but I was playing the cardboard before it was a Google Cardboard, sure. When it was the USC MXR lab project, you know, and I went home excitedly and built one from the plans they had there. It's neat. It's a very, very neat way to get that, you get part of that experience. But when you put on the HTC Vive helmet, which is tethered, but what happens is you have sensors on the wall that tell you where you are in space. So if you take three steps, it moves with you. Mm-hmm. Which is very different. Where I describe, like, you know, Oculus, and Oculus is still, it's like VR or cardboard and all that, where you're sort of fixed in space and you look around and you still got to use a controller or something to move. Whereas the HTC Vive and the other stuff apps actually move with you, and it creates a completely different sensory experience. One is like sticking your head underwater and like, hey, look, I'm in the ocean. The other one is walking around the floor of the ocean.
Right.
Well, and I think what HTC has wanted, and in the point of a lot of their demos, and I know what has Scott Johnson very excited, is the idea of it being a little bit more of a utilitarian application, that it's not just, you know, whereas Oculus has a lot of like experiential, sit down, now you're in a spaceship, sit down, now you're in a canoe going over a waterfall. Like, you know, like there's all these different elements. The HTC is, hey, walk around, now you're grabbing things. Like, walk around, now you're painting. And that's what I feel like, that's their different sort of turn on it. And I think that's very interesting, because you could see, even for artists, you know, like Scott Johnson is dedicating a room for that device so he can draw and paint.
Incredible. Yeah, I've used that, the painting thing. You know, you have a sensor in both hand, and you hold up a palette and you see it, you touch your brush to it and it glows, and you paint three-dimensionally in a room that feels realistic. It was the most profound experience I had. It was a far more profound experience than even my first time trying VR. And that's going to come out theoretically in April, and I think that where Oculus is going to where it is, when I got my dev kit and I played around with it, I realized it's for video games. It's for making video games more intense, for sitting in your chair in front of your PC and being that. It's not that next big leap. It's just for taking your PC screen and wrapping it all around you. And that's why I think this year is going to be big about gaming, very, very big about VR gaming. I think that as after a while, then it'll start to get more into all the other cool stuff. But I think this year is where we see VR gaming become a bigger thing, but not VR.
All right, so predictions. I need your help, both of you guys, to help me figure out how to make this a quantifiable prediction. But yeah. I feel like 2016 is going to be the year that we see some important version of the Turing test totally passed.
That was one of my predictions here.
Oh, really? That's great. No, I feel like we're at a critical mass, and I don't know if it's going to be like the first program that you could carry on a 5-minute conversation. You know, maybe it's a time limit, configuration, or maybe it's a subject limited configuration. But I feel like we're going to see the headline Turing test passed, full stop, for the first time.
Yeah, I don't know that we'll. I mean, we've seen that headline before.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if that my prediction was we're going to see something really freaky with robotics, in the idea that we're going to see some next level things as far as something walking around and looking and really just seeming much more eerie and human like. But I would say that I think that, yeah, we're going to start getting our next generation of intelligent assistants, and that's going to be pretty freaky.
Pretty great, to be honest. I'm very excited about it.
I predict that by this time next year, augmented reality will not necessarily be, I think Magic Leap will debut something. We will see it even on a kind of boutique, reservation invite only kind of level out. And we are going to enter back into the world of, augmented reality or some visual assist wearable be the new buzzword, in a way that, you know, wrist wearables were in 2015.
So you're not saying we're going to have it. You're saying that'll be the hype engine.
Leap will do something that is like, oh, cool. That just opens up that world for people to think this is the new hotness. That glasses with these kinds of real-time augmented reality stuff.
You don't think that there's been a significant setback, number one, by the current state of technology, number two, by the sort of PR debacle that was Google Glass?
The total failure of Google Glass?
Yeah.
No, because I think that, you know, not any more than I think the Virtual Boy hurt the Oculus Rift.
Well,
you know,
I mean, it did. That was 20 years ago, and we're only just now limping
faster these days.
I think that you know, Microsoft was building tablets before Apple came out with the iPad, and then Apple said, "We think you need to have a couple things to really make it work, right? You know, you need to be thinking more of a portable device and not a desktop crammed into this multi-touch and all that." And then once that happened, people were like, "Oh yeah, look at these things." And well, they weren't technically on one level new, but there was sufficiently enough to be that. And people didn't care that they failed before. People didn't care that they were crappy things before because there was enough of something. I think that with Magic Leap, you know, Magic Leap. The problem with HoloLens, and HoloLens is certainly a lot better than Google Glass, but when Google Glass first did that demo, I'm excited. I'm like, this looks amazing. And then you start getting into the little fine print, and you find out, oh no, only one eye sees this thing, and it's off in the corner. It's not augmented reality. And I'm like, well, that's dumb. I have no use for that. I have use for this thing that takes up my field of view and can overlay on top of things and do that. That ain't it. Microsoft came out with HoloLens, and we're all optimistically excited because we're like, this could be the new thing. This could be the really cool thing. And then but we're like waiting. Like, what's the catch? What's the catch? Well, it's a little window in front of your field of view that as soon as you just look a couple degrees to the side, the thing vanishes. So you're not creating a persistent illusion. You're creating this sort of monocle little thing that you look through this box, which, you know, and that's the big crit. Is it technically, it's an incredible achievement.
Yeah.
But it's not there.
Hey man, we are running a little bit long now. You want to do a fast version of picks? I got one queued up if you guys are ready.
Go for it.
It's a repeat. Andrew recommended it before, but in the wake of Star Wars Fever, I guess two picks. There are two things I did that I enjoyed a lot, both Star Wars related. First of all, if you've ever heard the Red Letter Media's Phantom Menace review, then you know the genius of the Mr. Plinkett reviews. You know that they give very insightful, both spellings of the words, reviews. And, you know, these are guys who got famous by making three sets of videos just slaying the prequels. And beneath it all is this simmering rage and love for the Star Wars franchise or whatever. They also do a show called Half in the Bag, where it's a different conceit. They mainly just sit around and chat about movies. But they did an hour-plus long review of the new Star Wars movie, and spoiler alert, they loved it, and it was totally rad to see these guys who have made their bones by just decimating the prequels. Just and they acknowledged its flaws. They did explore things that could have been done differently or whatever. But overall, to see them like, no, it's still great though. It was a lot of fun. It was a Star Wars movie I'd always wanted. A lot of fun. So if you just search Red Letter Media, Half in the Bag, Star Wars, The Force Awakens.
Not without their ability to take shots at George Lucas, which, you know, which they do repeatedly.
Sure.
You know, and I think that the thing that we're entering in the phase is that there are people who are then going to go see it and like, well, that's a flaw and that's a flaw and that's a flaw. And like, well, yeah, you're right. But you know what? It was still really, there was so much awesomeness in there. And that's the thing. That was my personal journey was, you know, like, and that's why I didn't come out and say anything until I'd had my, you know, third viewing or whatever like that, because I said, I don't want to be the guy that's like, well, you know, why don't they do this and do this, missing everything that was done beautifully and wonderfully. And I've seen that in some of the criticisms now. We're like, well, there's this like, yeah, but no, you know, if you don't like Kylo Ren, I can't help you. If you don't get the fact that why he's so interesting, you know.
Oh, no.
You know?
I was going to verge into spoilery territory.
How about this for a spoiler? It's going to become the highest grossing movie domestically of all time within a month.
Yeah.
Within a month, it is going to crush Avatar. And I don't mean within a month from now. I mean most likely within a month of release. Like it will, it released in December, it will beat Avatar.
Yeah,
like,
dude. $511 million domestic already. That's crazy. So my other recommendation is, and I believe, am I remembering correctly that it's posted on archive.org, but the Star Wars radio drama, because it was great. You know, my middle child, Josie, heard us talking about it. She's like, "Dad, what's this Star Wars thing? Like, I know there's a Luke Skywalker or something, you know, explain this to me." And I was like, "Well, you know, you're going to bed, but you can listen to the story." And Josie didn't cotton to the radio drama, but Penny loved it. She's already finished the first one. She's going on to Empire next. And it's so great because as far as audio production technology, there's been a substantial leveling off over the last 50 years or so. I don't know, 40 years of audio production. And as a result, the Star Wars radio drama survives so well. I got halfway through re-listening to the whole thing myself. When you listened to it, Andrew, was it up on archive.org? Was it free or?
I got it from Audible.
Okay. All right. Well, it's definitely on Audible. I think you can find – oh, as a matter of fact, it looks like people – Balloon Knots in the chat looks like they – have. Yeah, there it is. It's available for freezies at archive.org.
My favorite and also the most awkward part is the Darth Vader Princess Leia interrogation scene.
Oh no. Which part was awkward about it?
He's used weird hypnotic technique. He's like, "Tell your father." You know, your father wants to know.
Oh, that's right.
The Vader is a little bit weird, but he's a very angry. But
incredible performance by Mark Hamill. I mean
he's great.
Prescient of his future amazing successes in audio recording entertainment.
You know, and it's funny because, like, you know, there are people who will sometimes criticize his performance in Star Wars and stuff, and I thought that he nailed that part perfectly.
I mean, he was unlikable and whiny and wishy-washy, but so was Luke Skywalker.
Yeah, but he was still like – I mean, he was this guy that was – if you sit back and you go, "Oh, man, no, this guy's been given the short end of the stick, and it's what he's put up with, and he's whining, but he's really whining for, like, he's been lied to, he's been manipulated, and he's put up with so much, you know," which I kind of like – and you look like, "No, I think he handled that really well." And then when it's time to stand up, he's like, "Oh, well, I'm going to do the right thing." And they also – what's funny about the radio drama too is there's a lot of explaining of, like, you know, that's good because they're like – you know, Leia's, you know, Luke's like, "Yeah, you know," like, they're the point where, you know, Ben dies and Leia's consoling him. And he's like, "Well, you know, your whole planet died too." It's like, "Yes, but I can't focus on that right now. I have to move on." And so they kind of address a lot of those criticisms about, you know, why wasn't this called attention to, you know, why did this happen or whatever? And just sort of like, "All right, nerds."
Oh, Spoilsport GGG in the chat is saying that the archive.org thing is just images of it. So you might actually have to pay for it. But if you do, it is so, so, so worth it. Mm-hmm. If you have the means, I highly recommend it.
Oh, yeah, no, it's so legit.
I have a pick that I'm still in progress. So if it sucks, I will rescind it. But by all accounts, everybody else, Tom Merritt liked it and other people liked it. And there was a lot of excitement when they announced that, hey, and, you know, frustration when they threw out all the expanded universe because they wanted to make way for telling new stories and they didn't want to have the baggage of, and they didn't want people going in and saying, "I know what happens next," for, you know, based on a book that maybe was written, you know, by a mid-list writer in 2 weeks, you know, where there might be a better solution. But they did the new series they started. First, they had the book Star Wars Aftermath, which I haven't listened to. I kind of just, you know, the feedback on that didn't make me very excited to get into it, so I passed on it. But the one that people loved was Star Wars Lost Wars, which is a young adult novel by Claudia Gray, which is about two young people who join the Empire and one ends up going in the Rebellion. And so it's the back and forth. It's sort of a Romeo and Juliet story. And so far, maybe an hour and a half into it, it's a neat kind of example of what's it like if you're on some godforsaken planet in the middle of nowhere and the Empire comes there, and they show the point of view of, like, if, you know, these really poor people, they're excited, you know, like, "Yay, the Empire's here. This is great." And it's this really interesting sort of tale of what's life like in the Star Wars universe. And then another pick is, if you want a cheap Audible pick, don't use a credit, but you can just buy it for $2, is Perfect Weapon, which is the, remember the girl, the, I will not do spoilers, but a girl at Maz's castle with the black fingertips.
Uh-huh.
It's a story of her, like a mission that she goes on before.
Oh, no kidding.
You know, it's not like, oh my God, this is amazing, but it's kind of a cool, you know, Star Wars.
But it's probably not canon. It's probably Star Wars Legends, which, by the way, the more I've sat with it.
It's canon.
Wait, I thought books would never be canon. I thought books would be all under the Legends category.
No, I think
all the previous books,
extended universe stuff is now Star Wars Legends.
Okay. And which, by the way, the more I sit with, the more I'm okay with. The idea that around a campfire, every tiny town has a story of when Han Solo made it through their area.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But then, I think everything that's coming out now that is being blessed by Central Office, that is canon.
Right on. What about you, Justin?
Hey, two things that I watched. Me and Ash got sick, so we watched some TV. We watched, caught up on Portlandia. Portlandia is still great. We actually got a lot of Kirsten Dunst in our lives. There's a really funny opening skit with Kirsten Dunst in the most recent episode of Portlandia that's up on Netflix. And I said to Ashley last night, I'm like, all right, there's these like four things that people are talking about. Let's sit down and watch some TV. We whittle down what she wants to watch, and eventually we land on Fargo. And I'm like, cool, make sure. Season one of Fargo. We'll start with season one. We know that we can watch. I mean, they're two separate things, but let's watch season one. Then we'll watch season two. So make sure you watch season one. Make sure you watch season one. I got to run, go do something. Make sure you buy season one on iTunes. We get there. It opens up, and they're talking about Ronald Reagan, which I know plays a part in season two. And I'm like, sweetheart, you bought season two. We're watching season two. Thankfully, they're two totally different stories that they don't necessarily connect with each other.
This is wonderful, though, because I've wondered if it might not even be better to watch season two first, and you're a natural experiment of that. Also, secondly, I would love to buy a season pass to watch Justin's Domestic Disputes, the oncoming series that I get to.
Oh, my God. Listen, number one, just follow twitch.tv/fakegamergirl. I swear to God, between this, everything that we do, and the fact that Ashley is now streaming so much on Twitch, there is effectively, we have just built our own We Live in Public box, because we are streaming out of this apartment probably 22 out of the 24 hours of the day.
That's amazing.
So we started watching season two of Fargo. We got about three episodes in, so in a 10 episode season, that's pretty far into it. Man, it is kind of one of the most rad achievements in this kind of modern age of television that you could take looking at Star Wars and Fargo in the same world, where it's like, hey, look, let's just have new voices take on these aesthetics, and let's start thinking about voice and pace as genre, right? That let's start thinking about the Coen brothers as a genre. Let's think of a Star Wars as a genre, and let's write within it and understand what beats you want and what makes it fun and interesting, and let's hew to that. Man, we're in just such an amazing world of creativity right now, because you watch Fargo and it's like, wow, this is like so 70s in the way that Fargo, the original movie, was so early 90s, and it is, man, it is like 70s with underlined, bolded, italicized, where in like literally every little element of it is kind of there, almost to the point of parody, but in that larger than life Coen brothers kind of way. Super fun. Characters are great. Acting's amazing. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. No, the very first episode turned me off with, I'm sure you can figure what element was a bit much for me in the first episode that I felt was unnecessary.
It's so 70s. It's like the fact that that people are seeing this is so 70s.
To be honest, like that is so 70s, but it's like, if you wanted to make me see it that way, then they should have, from a visual effects perspective, made it look like those artifacts of the time. Instead, it just looked very out of place in 70s.
That didn't bother me, because that's how I imagine that character saw it. I imagine that character saw that the way that we see it.
All right, enough. I'll watch it.
Oh, wait, you haven't seen it?
No.
It's wonderful.
And I'm going to double down on something else. I finally watched the entire first season of Man in the High Castle.
Oh, I'm only like three or four episodes in. It worth taking the rest of the trip?
Did you like the first? Did you like the pilot?
I loved the pilot. The second episode, I felt like they hit the brakes on everything, and it sort of. Well, actually, the second episode was okay. Third episode, it was the most recent one I'd seen. The big bad guy is just a little too over the top for me, and it's hard for me to get excited about coming back in.
Wait, which bad guy?
The bounty hunter guy. He's, you know, a bit cartoony.
Yes. He is the most over the top element of it, and he's not. He's. You get more of Rufus Sewell building. You get more of the. I really enjoyed it. I really liked how they built it. I really like with Rufus Sewell's character, who's the Offenfuhrer or whatever. You know, which I love that stuff. You know, getting more into him. Everybody is complex. You know, the guy, the Compitop, the guy who's the head of the Compitop, the Japanese police, who starts off as this, you know, kind of jerk. He still sort of is, but you realize how everybody's trying to function with their own code of ethics and stuff for the most part. And well, you watch people do horrific, you know, horrific stuff happens, but you know, they've kind of bought into the PR. You know, we talked in earlier about, you know, the Malthusianism arguments and stuff like that. And there's a great piece by Matt Ridley today. If you go to Rational Optimist, which talks about how much of Malthusian arguments about population, all that, how that led into Nazi sterilization and concentration camps, et cetera, and all that. And I think that this is a very good, it gets smart, and you get into what is it like, what's life like inside of the Reich? How do you see yourselves? You know, how do you see what you do? And how do some people live with it or not, et cetera? So I've been very impressed by the way that's progressed. Bounty Hunter, absolutely right. He's just, I think he's a good actor in general, but that character was just a bit much. But I think everything else I really dug, so.
Right on. Man, dude, what a great action-packed episode. We'll do after things after this. One thing I forgot to mention on the Patreon plug is, look, if you want to contribute, that's wonderful, and we certainly appreciate it, and it keeps this as one of our regular achievements. But I get a lot of people saying out of everything that me and Justin that Weird Things is the most approachable. So if you're not going to donate, if you're not comfortable taking that step and signing up as a patron, do us a favor. Introduce our silly show to one of your friends. And
you get a tattoo on your forehead.
Yeah. No, that works.
Yeah. It's binary. Either give us money or get a tattoo. You have only two choices, and we will be checking on Friday.
One or the other.
But yeah, thank you, everybody. It's been a great year for Weird Things. Thank you all for going on this weird journey with us.
It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.